Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of the Cancer Horizons podcast. Each week, we'll be hearing from patients, survivors, caregivers, advocates, and healthcare professionals to do what CURE does best, provide cancer updates, research, and education. Have you ever thought that reading the fine print of a scan could save your life? When David Sturgis, an attorney from New Elm, Minnesota, went to the doctor for a CAT scan to assess his risk for a heart disease, he wasn't expecting a lung cancer diagnosis. After all, he had quit smoking for almost 20 years and was only 53 years old. However, when the scan came back with a footnote noting that there was a mass nodule on the lobe of his right lung, David immediately went in for a biopsy. In February 2002, he was diagnosed with stage 1A non-small lung cancer and shortly after had a lobectomy, the removal of the lower lobe of the right lung. A year later, his doctor noticed a new suspicious mass and recommended him for another surgery. When David sought a second opinion, the new oncologist stated he did not recommend surgery at the time. With regular screening that monitored the growth of the tumor, he was able to avoid another surgery until 2017. On today's episode of Cancer Horizons, David, who is now 75 years old, shares how cancer treatments have changed in the past 21 years.
When I compare what was available to me 21 years ago to what is available now in treatment, diagnoses, and treatment is incredible.
His advocacy work with the Lung Cancer Foundation of America.
And our sole reason for being is to raise money for lung cancer research.
The importance of seeking genetic testing.
Having your tumor genetically tested. So based upon what your genetic result is, what the mutation is, found that your treatment can be much more potentially other than simply straight surgery.
Facing the stigma around smokers getting lung cancer.
Stigma is there. I'm not going to deny it.
And more.
Why don't you start by telling me kind of the basics, your name, your age?
My name is David Sturgis. I live in Minnesota. I'm a practicing attorney. I will be 75 in a couple of weeks. I was diagnosed with non-small cell lung cancer in February of 2002, ultimately had surgery in February of 2002, and the lower lobe of my right lung was removed, a lobectomy. I had continuing follow-up probably within a year after the first diagnosis and the surgery. There was concern about a suspicious mass, nodule, whatever term we really want to use, might not matter, that had to be watched closer. And within that 6 months to 8 month period, ultimately, my then surgeon recommended that he go in for another surgical removal of that mass. Bizarrely, the night before that surgery was scheduled, I had a heart attack. And so,
oh my God.
So that surgery did not take place. I recovered fine, and I feel I'm doing well today. Just came back from hiking in New Mexico with no problems, so all still is okay. But in any event, following that, obviously there had to be a waiting period in terms of whether or not I wanted to go ahead with that surgery, at which point I sought out another oncologist at the recommendation and suggestion of a friend who had been associated with the individual at UCLA. And I started going there for regular CAT scans and reviews every 3 months, and that suspicious mass was watched. This oncologist said, I do not recommend surgery at this point in time. And that's how it went, basically, for a period of time. It was CAT scans every 3 months, graduated to every 6 months, and ultimately I was on a yearly schedule. And in late 2016, I believe, they indicated, we think that the mass has grown. We're concerned. And they said, we've got to follow it up more. at their recommendation too, because of the idea that I might have surgery. They put me in touch with a surgeon and oncologist at Mayo Clinic here in Minnesota. They reviewed it as well. Another radiologist, Denny Aberle, who was part of the NLST, reviewed it as well, the scans, and said, I think so too. I think that it has grown. And so in August of 2017, I had surgery again. This time it was that surgery, video-assisted thoracic surgery. And there was a wedge resection in the upper lobe of my right lung, and I have been doing fine again ever since. That's it in a nutshell.
Yeah, I appreciate that. That's very concise. So the first time you were diagnosed, what was your stage?
Yes, stage 1A, yes. And
okay.
And I might add, because it is ironic, that, as with many people, it was a chance diagnosis. I had gone for what's called an EBCT, which is basically a CAT scan that looks for calcium plaque buildup, and it's usually used to set a benchmark going forward with respect to people that may or do have potential heart disease. There's quite a bit of heart disease in my family, and my cardiologist said, let's do that now. At that point, I would have been, about 53 years old. So I had the CAT scan, the EBCT, and it came back, as I say, ironically, saying that, no, that's within normal ranges. And it was literally a footnote that said, we noticed this mass, nodule, whatever you want to call it, on the lower lobe of the right lung. And if it's being followed, good, keep following it. If not, we suggest the patient go in for further follow-up on this, which I did, and it was looked at. I had a biopsy, and they said, you have lung cancer, and it went from there to surgery.
Did you do any chemo or radiation, or was it
No, I have never done. First time around, I wasn't even eligible for chemo or radiation therapy. That, the only therapy in my instance was surgery. Second time around, basically the same because of the size, no node involvement, et cetera, et cetera. Probably about two or three years after my initial surgery is when they said they were finding that adjuvant therapy in combination with surgery probably gave a better outcome for people in my situation. I remember asking my oncologist at UCLA, saying, well, now should I have chemo and radiation? And I laughed myself now, and he started to laugh. He said, good God, no, David, you're doing fine. I'm not going to go in there and start just doing radiation for the hell of it. And I said, I get it. But obviously, being in this situation, I think many people are always very alert to new treatments and wondering, is that treatment that I should be getting? And if not, why not? So on and so forth. So no, I have never had either of those treatments. I've had no other treatment, actually, other than the surgery both times.
Okay. And so after the first surgery, it sounds like the doctors had you set up pretty well on a plan for regular scans and regular monitoring. Is that true?
Correct. Absolutely.
Okay, so you didn't have to advocate for yourself on that or anything. They were on.
I did not. That was kind of set in stone. That was what was set up here in Minnesota after my first surgery, and then, as I say, after I started going to UCLA, it was continued, although the time frame was lengthened. In fact, I'm now here after this second surgery. I'm now at 1 year follow-up again, so cross your fingers.
Yeah. No, that's good news. Had they tried to follow, did they do any other monitoring other than the CT, regular CT scans? Did they do any other testing?
No. I mean, other than, obviously, before each scan, I'd have full panel of blood tests, exactly which each I can't tell you right now, but other than that, no.
any advice that you would give patients who are starting this or going through the process?
There's a whole broad range of suggestions. Number one is that they thoroughly review their case, that, or they get someone to help them review it in addition to their doctor. That particularly when I compare what was available to me 21 years ago to what is available now in terms of diagnosis and treatment, diagnoses and treatment is incredible. The fact that we have genetic testing, which goes very, very far in terms of treatment. And I think that's probably the real key in addition to carefully monitoring your condition. But having your tumor genetically tested so that hopefully, based upon what your genetic result is, the mutation is found, that your treatment can be much more potentially other than simply straight surgery, because there are other, as you well know, treatment methodologies specific to certain mutations. And I have emphasized that to people. Don't shove that aside. That's a good thing. Do it. And I'm also a big proponent of participating in drug trials. I explain to people, it is not like giving kerosene to you anymore. I said, for the most part, it is very safe. And I said, it can ultimately be very beneficial to you, and not only you, but to other people as well.
Great. When you had your first tumor taken out, I assume that they didn't have the scope of genetic testing to be able to look for that kind of...
Absolutely not. It was available here after my second one in 2017, and I requested the full panel, and at that point in time, Mayo was not unique. They said, we don't do a full panel in your instance because of the nature of the tumor. It's very small, and for a few other reasons, which quite frankly, Catherine, I can't remember. And I persisted. I said, I want it. And they said, well, you know, I said, I understand the cost, et cetera. I know that it may fall back on me as opposed to my insurer. And leading up to that surgery, it was a question asked each step of the way, and or should not say a question, but a request and a demand. And I do remember going into surgery, and they were just about ready to anesthetize me. And I turned, and I reminded the two doctors by me, I said, now don't forget. They just started to laugh. They said, David, we got the message. We don't know who else can give it to us. Your surgeon, this, that, the other thing. They said, we promise. And they were true to their word. And so it ultimately was sent to Foundation Medicine. But I did ultimately have trouble with my insurance saying, we don't cover this. This is, in essence, it's not called for. It's not standard of care treatment. And I wrote, I think, probably a 3 or 4 page letter just basically saying, you clearly don't understand the disease. You clearly do not understand genetic testing, on and on and on. And I said, it is standard of care today, and it's important standard of care, and it could be life-saving. They ultimately paid the bill with the caveat, they said, that they were basically, and I'm paraphrasing at this time, that based on what you've told us, your unique circumstances, which made me even madder because I wanted to write back and say, no, that's not the reason you should be giving it to me, but quite frankly, I took the $10,000 and ran. I think it's getting better now, but there's still, you know, some reluctance by the insurance companies.
Did they find anything in that testing, any interesting mutations that could be targeted if they were to have a recurrence?
Yes, in my instance, I have the EGFR mutation, which is the one of the mutations that has quite a bit, has been, I should say, kind of at the forefront in terms of potential treatment. But as I understand it, that it was EGFR for that tumor does not necessarily guarantee that if I have another tumor that it will be the EGFR mutation. That's my understanding. I would have to go back and look, but it's not, as I understand it, it's not a guarantee.
I have to ask the question of if you have ever been a smoker or have a genetic predisposition to lung cancer.
I understand you asking the question. I was a smoker. I had smoked for the time of my diagnosis, I would say, yeah, I had smoked for about 17, 18 years, maybe a little longer. But I also had stopped smoking almost 15, 20 years prior to my diagnosis. Again, not an unusual situation. We, again, probably statistics you know, they're finding and have found that a good percentage of those ultimately diagnosed with lung cancer have quit at least 10 years or more. I remember talking with Clay Shaw, who was a congressman from Florida and very active in Congress in terms of getting money for cancer research and specifically lung cancer research. And he said he had quit smoking 30 years prior to being diagnosed with lung cancer, and he ultimately died from lung cancer.
Do you find a lot of the stigma out in the world when you talk about lung cancer and how lung cancer is treated differently than potentially other cancers in terms of attention and resources?
Stigma is there. I'm not going to deny it, and I don't want to sound Pollyannish, but I try to simply drive through it that, okay, you know, there are prejudices out there on any numbers of things, but here's my message. At the end of the day, people, we need the money for research. The research has to go on. And would I like it that people aren't prejudging and aren't asking? Absolutely. But I just feel I just have to keep going forward with the message of, look, the money isn't there, and we need the money for research, and hopefully we can find a cure or at least enough treatment options that makes it, like many other diseases, sad to say, with which we live and go forward. I think a real, real game changer is going to be in terms of the idea of the stigma is the recent study out of Ireland that very specifically points to air pollution as a potential cause of lung cancer. And there's also a researcher here in the United States, Joan Schiller, I think she's still at the University of Virginia, who has been researching the same thing. Once that is, if you will, concrete in my mind, that's going to change the whole idea of stigma, you know, completely. You also have to look at, and the emphasis has to be on, those people that have never smoked. It's a significant percentage who then are diagnosed with lung cancer. And then you add on, arguably, people like myself, people like Clay Shaw, who hadn't smoked anywhere from 10 to 30 years. And so, yeah, I get it that it's a smoker's disease in many respects, but at the same time, why is it then that we have a good percentage who had quit smoking previously? And that may be where the predisposition is in terms of potential mutations. Just, you know, once you start smoking, boom, regardless of the length of time you've smoked, so on and so forth.
Are you doing some work with some of the not-for-profits?
I am one of the founders of Lung Cancer Foundation of America, and our sole reason for being is to raise money for lung cancer research, for innovative treatment modalities, and ultimately something that might lead to a cure. We started it in 2009 with myself, Kim Norris, who's the president, her husband, died of lung cancer. I think Roy was in his late 40s. And the third was Lori Monroe, who was a cast nurse in Bowling Green, Kentucky. And she was diagnosed, I believe, in her late 40s as well. And sad to say, Lori has since died. Mm-hmm. So yes, I've been very active in terms of sounding the alarm of the need for research and the need for money to support research. And we started at our foundation because we were concerned that we weren't getting, if you will, a fair share from NCI, from the National Cancer Institute, that not enough money, not enough focus. I also served for 9 years on the Department of Defense's lung cancer program that does grant money for lung cancer research. And I was the only patient advocate on the National Lung cancer screening trial.
Wow.
So yes, I have been involved.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Cancer Horizons podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or other apps to hear every episode, or visit curetoday.com/podcasts. The Cancer Horizons podcast is the official podcast of Cure Magazine, the indispensable guide to every stage of the cancer experience. For more information, visit us at curetoday.com and find us on Twitter @cure_magazine or at Facebook @curemagazine.